But someone will say, well, what about Matthew 5, verses 38 and 39? Ye have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, resist not him that is evil, but whoever smites thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. No, there is no inconsistency here either. This advice was never given to the nation, that we should surrender to communism and leave the world in slavery. It was given only to individuals, and just to certain particular individuals at that. Jesus was preaching to bring his truths before all who had the qualities to respond to him and who would become his disciples. These would be that first generation of Christians whose responsibility above all else was to spread his word without being distracted by petty quarrels with other people. They were to face ridicule, contempt, and hatred. Every day they would be given provocation by insults and injuries. If they let themselves react with natural anger, they would be in constant quarrels and fights. They would be constantly arrested and in jail, not as noble martyrs to a great cause, but as brawlers constantly fighting in the streets over personal quarrels, which would not be a good recommendation for the new religion of Christianity. Even if they didn't fight, but looked to the law to vindicate their rights, this would make them spend all their time and energy in lawsuits instead of in their missionary work. This was not the duty of the early Christians, but that he did not intend that they should tamely let themselves be slaughtered by ruffians is clear. In Luke 22, verse 36, he told his disciples that he that had no sword should sell his cloak and buy one. So many erroneous religious doctrines come from the mistake of taking out of context words spoken for a certain time and place and trying to make universal, eternal rules of them. In Matthew 14, verse 19, and Mark 6, verse 39, when Jesus Christ was about to feed the multitude with a few loaves and fishes, we read that he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass. This certainly does not mean that today it is a Christian's duty to go around making people sit down on the grass. It was spoken only under the special circumstances of a particular time and place, and no one should try to make a doctrine of it. So also with Jesus Christ's instructions to the early Christians to stick to the job for which he had chosen them and not to waste time quarreling with the wicked. But don't ever think that if you see some ruffian trying to rape your wife and daughter, you should merely stand around murmuring pious platitudes about the desirability of good conduct. Your duty, and I do mean duty, as a good Christian, is to stop him even if you have to kill him to do it. So much for the individual. But this Hindu was trying to place Christian nations, not India, nor China, nor Russia, under the individual's restrictions. God always distinguished between the rules for the individual and the rules for the nation. Particularly is this true of the laws of war. It is only when we have been guilty of evil conduct and disloyalty to our God that he has allowed wicked nations to oppress us until we repented of our evil ways. Then he has himself used us as his own servant and agent to make war against those wicked nations. He began our training in this early. When our ancestors came out of Egypt in the Exodus, they were attacked by the Amalekites. For this, God said that he would have war with Amalek from generation to generation until he had utterly blotted out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And this duty he commanded his people Israel to perform, as we read in Exodus 17. Verses 14 to 16, and Deuteronomy 25, verses 7 to 19. But that is only the beginning. In Jeremiah 51, verse 20, God himself said to our ancestors, and to us today, their descendants, thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, and with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. Is there anything pacifistic about that? Evil must not be allowed to rule the earth in triumph. To those who are good, you can speak in a language they understand, the language of peace and reason. But to those who are utterly evil, you must also speak in the only language they understand. Russia and China can't understand platitudes. They can understand nothing but superior force. Again, we read in the 7th chapter of Judges how God sent Gideon with only 300 men to deliver Israel from the huge army of the Midianites. And he routed the Midianites with the slaughter of 120,000 men. We are clearly told that this was by the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. Neither let yourself be misled by someone quoting, "They that take the sword shall perish by the sword." Note that this speaks of two swords, the sword of the aggressor, who shall perish by the sword of the defender. Lest anyone should say that this is only a characteristic of earthly man, a relic of the past, and that we should look forward to a higher, nobler character to be attained in the future, let us examine the book of Revelation in its description of Jesus Christ when he returns to reign over all the world as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. In Revelation 19, verse 11, it says of Jesus Christ that in righteousness he does judge and make war. Jesus Christ himself recognizes that there can never be peaceful coexistence between good and evil. One must certainly conquer, the other must certainly perish. If good has not the will and the courage to be the conqueror, then evil will rule supreme. So long as evil exists, there will be wars. The wars of evil's aggression against good, until good conquers and exterminates evil. And this last great war to wipe out evil will be led by no less a general than our Redeemer, Jesus Christ. When he comes, let him find you not hiding under the bed in abject terror, but marching resolutely in the ranks of his army. Today I want to talk about God's battle axe. As all of our regular listeners know, I lay great emphasis on Bible prophecies and their fulfillment, for both the Old and the New Testaments repeatedly say that this is the proof of the genuineness and inspiration of the Scriptures, as well as being of vital importance for our guidance. Many of these prophecies deal with war, not only with the wars of the wicked against us, but also with our duty to have our part in God's wars against the wicked. There is no pacifism in the Bible. Only under Jesus Christ's personal government of the world can there ever be peace. I want to talk with you about our duties in the meantime in this imperfect world. God knew that we must defend ourselves against the wicked, and he promised us his help at such time. In Deuteronomy 20, verses 3 and 4, he tells us, "Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day unto battle with your enemies. Let not your hearts faint, fear not, and do not tremble, neither be ye terrified because of them. For Yahweh your God is he that goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." Again in Deuteronomy 2, verse 25, God said, "This day will I begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations that are under the whole heaven, who shall hear report of thee, and shall tremble and be in anguish because of thee." Repeatedly he tells us, "Ye shall not fear them, for Yahweh your God, he shall fight for you." Of course, to get the greatest protection, we must obey our God. For in Leviticus 26, verses 3 and 6 to 8, he says, "If ye walk in my statutes, and keep my commandments, and do them, I will give peace in the land, and ye shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And I will rid evil beasts out of the land, neither shall the sword go through your land. And ye shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword, and five of you shall chase 100. And 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword." Let there be no doubt of this. He is a God of peace to those who love him and obey him. But to the wicked, who try to overthrow all his rule in this world, he is, as Exodus 15, verse 3 says, a man of war. Psalm 24, verse 8 reminds us, "Who is this King of glory? Yahweh, strong and mighty, Yahweh, mighty in battle." So in Psalm 18, verses 32, 34, and 39, David says, "It is God that girds me with strength and makes my way perfect. He teaches my hands to war, so that a bow of steel is broken by my arms. For thou hast girded me with strength unto the battle. Thou hast subdued under me those that rose up against me." And 2 Samuel 1, verse 18 records that David required that the men of Judah be taught to use the bow. But there was more to this than just the mere defense of ourselves against direct attack by our enemies. It is our job to be God's policemen in this world, and we must be ready, willing, and able to do it. In Jeremiah 51, verse 20, God himself gives us our orders, saying, "Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms." He will use his great power to see that we are victorious, but we can't hide under the bed at home while his work is done. We must do our part in it with serene confidence in his protection. In Isaiah 54, verses 15 and 17, God says, "Behold, they shall surely gather together, but not by me. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of Yahweh, and their righteousness is of me, saith Yahweh." But remember, keeping the world in order is doing God's work, and we must do it, for he has said that we shall. If we decide that we are so much more righteous than God that we can make our own rules and say that surrender to evil is better than enforcing the right, then we should remember that terrible warning given in Jeremiah 48, verse 10. "Cursed be he that does the work of Yahweh negligently, and cursed be he that keeps back his sword from blood." To be the instrument in God's hands by which he brings righteousness and justice into an unwilling world is an honor, and that is what God's word calls it. The 149th Psalm says it clearly. "Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth, and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the heathen, and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honor have all his saints. Praise ye Yahweh." Now I can just see someone wishing he could break into this broadcast to say that this is from the Old Testament, but God was all wrong and all this was done away with by the New Testament. Well, I have news for you. God was always right, so he didn't have to change his mind nor be taught higher ethics by men. Let's see what the New Testament says. In Matthew 10, verse 34, Jesus Christ himself says, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword." And in Luke 22, verse 36, Jesus Christ told his disciples, "He that has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." And Jesus Christ didn't have to change his mind either, because in Revelation 19, verse 11, we read this about him. "And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he does judge and make war." You see, peace never comes by cooperation with Satan or with Satan's children and followers. You can't coexist with a cancer. Either you must cut it out completely or it will kill you. Both cannot survive. Therefore, the only true Prince of Peace must be in complete control over a world from which evil has been driven out. Only then can the words of Micah 4, verses 1 to 3 be fulfilled. "But in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of Yahweh shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, Come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Now notice that this does not come through the might of Khrushchev and the wisdom of Tito in that parliament of all evil, the United Nations. It is done only by the might of God. Therefore, we read how this will be done in Isaiah 66, verses 15 and 16. For behold, Yahweh will come with fire and with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword will Yahweh plead with all flesh, and those slain by Yahweh shall be many. Whether we like it or not, God himself has said to us, Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. But we should like it. Those who serve God willingly receive the reward therefore. But willing or not, we must all obey him. If we obey the laws of our God and follow confidently where he leads, we may be sure of his blessing. Five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. I would much rather face Russia and China on this basis than to have to face them anyway as a punishment because we have defied our God and sought coexistence with Satan. But I started this morning's broadcast with the statement that I place great emphasis on Bible prophecy and its fulfillment. How about these prophecies I have quoted to you? Have they been fulfilled? Have the tribes of Israel and their later descendants, the Scythians, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, the Angli and the Saxons, and in our modern times the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Germanic nations, have they fulfilled these prophecies? Yes, indeed we have. And it is strange that the churches, which claim to be teaching the Word of God, have not honored him with the proof that he always keeps his word. But my time for today is about used up. In my next broadcast, we shall see that history proves that God always makes good his word. We have. Today I want to complete our subject, God's battle axe. In my last broadcast, we saw that God had promised his people Israel great military power under his own protection. And he had further prophesied that he would use their military power to destroy the heathen kingdoms, saying in Jeremiah 51, verse 20, Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. And in Isaiah 54, verses 15 and 17, God says, Behold, they shall surely gather together, but not by me. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of Yahweh, and their righteousness is of me, saith Yahweh. Fine words, surely, but were they made good? Yes, indeed they were. History shows the clear fulfillment of these prophecies. You will remember that we have traced the people of Israel after their deportation by the Assyrians into the lands around the south end of the Caspian Sea, where they became known to the Greeks as Scuths, to the Romans as Scythians, and to the Persians as Sacca, which in course of time became Saccasins, then Saxons. Other tribes became known as the Angli, and yet others as the Goths, who were divided into the Ostrogoths, or East Goths, and the Visigoths, or West Goths. Now, let's see what these Israelite tribes did. A generation sufficed for them to fully throw off the Assyrian yoke, and they became a numerous and powerful people. Their constant warfare against the Assyrians was not enough to conquer Assyria, but it did bleed the Assyrians white, as the saying is. Finally, the Scythians became allies of the Medes, their neighbors to the east, and the allied Median and Scythian armies captured Nineveh in 606 B.C., and the Assyrian Empire then disappeared from ancient history. About 550 B.C., Cyrus the Great of Persia conquered Media and absorbed Media into the greater Persian Empire. By this time, the Babylonian captivity of Judah had been in effect for half a century. Remember Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great image which the prophet Daniel interpreted for him? The image's head of gold was Nebuchadnezzar's own Babylonian Empire, the first of the four great heathen empires which dominated world history. The image's breast and arms of silver represented the Medo-Persian Empire. The belly and thighs of brass was the Greco-Macedonian Empire of Alexander the Great, which extended from Greece through all Western Asia, even into northern India. And the legs of iron were the Roman Empire. Scythians were allies of the great Medo-Persian army of Cyrus, which conquered the empire of Babylon and released a few of the captives of Judah and Benjamin to go back to Palestine. But what happened to the many other people of Judah and Benjamin who did not return to Palestine? History records that the Scythians swooped down on the region around Babylon and took back with them most of the people of Judah and Benjamin, leaving behind the few who went back to Palestine. The fall of Babylon was not solely the work of the Israelite Scythians, of course. The prophesied rise of the Medo-Persian Empire at this time required that the glory should go to it. Yet Scythian Israel did play some part in it, even though not a large one. But Cyrus was ambitious, greedy, and ungrateful for the help his Scythian allies had given him. 9 years after the fall of Babylon, Cyrus led a great army to attack the Scythians, and he was killed in the battle. His defeated army had to retreat. His successor, Darius I, raised a far greater army and led them north against the Scythians. His armies were too great for the Scythians to fight, so, being a nomadic people, they retreated northward before him, keeping always tantalizingly just out of reach, while the weary Persians got farther and farther away from their base of supply at home. The pursuit continued deep into the Caucasus Mountains, the people of Scythian Israel crossing through the great pass which is now occupied by the Georgian military road, but which from their day down to our own times has borne the name the Pass of Israel. At the tremendous chasm of the Darial Gorge, which even a handful of Scythians could have defended against his army, Darius turned back, and he left his name to the place to this day. Alexander the Great set up his huge empire in the 11 years between 334 and 323 B.C., conquering and absorbing the Persian Empire in the process. Thus the belly and thighs of brass succeeded the breast and arms of silver. No enemy overthrew Alexander's empire. It just fell apart into four quarters at his death, as the prophet Daniel had prophesied. However, Bactria, largely consisting of modern Afghanistan and eastern Persia, remained part of the Seleucid quarter of the old Alexandrian Empire, and Alexander had penetrated India as far as the Punjab. And again we find Scythian Israel performing its job as God's battle axe. In 128 B.C., the Scythians overran northern Persia, defeated several Persian armies, and collected tribute from several successive Persian kings. Next, beginning about 126 B.C., the Scythians invaded Bactria, overthrew the Seleucid rulers, went on through Afghanistan and the Khyber Pass into India, where they set up a strong kingdom in the Punjab and part of Rajputana, which remained powerful until the 5th century A.D. However, the fate of all invaders of India met them. They finally mongrelized their blood with that of the dark local races, and their greatness ended. However, the Jats, who were about half the population of the Punjab, and some of the Rajput tribes, still show some traces of the Scythian blood. The rest of Alexander's empire still had its part to play in history, but this northeastern quarter of it was destroyed by Scythian Israel. Finally, Rome, the legs of iron, came on the scene and absorbed the other three quarters of Alexander's empire. It ran its allotted course, but its overthrow finally came at the hands of God's battle axe and weapons of war. Nearly all the people of migrating Israel were by now deep in Europe, many of them already in Germany and around the shores of the Baltic Sea. In the year 410 A.D., the Visigoths completed their conquest of Italy by the capture of the city of Rome. However, they held Italy only a few years, then moved on out, many of them going into southern France and northern Spain, where they settled permanently. However, the other half of the powerful nation of the Goths, the Ostrogoths, were yet to play their part against Rome. In A.D. 493, the Ostrogoths conquered all Italy, including Rome itself, and set up an Ostrogothic kingdom in Italy. While this lasted as an independent kingdom only until A.D. 552, it still marked the final and total end of the glory that was Rome. God's battle axe and weapons of war had destroyed the last of the Babylonian succession of empires. From that time on, we are in the period of modern European history. We know how these people developed into the great nations which made modern history, which indeed are modern history. The Bible gives scant attention to the old lands in Western Asia, other than prophecies concerning Jesus Christ and their fulfillment, for the reason that it is no longer the land in which God's people Israel dwell. The Arabian Empire receives doubtful mention in an obscure passage in the book of Revelation and clear mention in just one other verse in the Bible. The Turkish Empire is ignored, for it had no effect upon Israel. But the Israel nations in Europe still were God's battle axe and weapons of war. They expanded in all directions. They conquered and ruled India. They shattered and destroyed the Turkish Empire when the times of the Gentiles expired in 1917. They forced Russia back into Asia in the Crimean War. They conquered China and compelled it to open its ports freely to trade with the world. The Israel nation, the United States, smashed the great Japanese Empire. True, their wars have been costly in both blood and treasure. God's promises of easy victory were among the conditional promises made through Moses. To get easy victory, we must obey our God and keep His laws. Then it will be true that five of us shall chase 100 of the enemy, and 100 of us will put 10,000 to flight. Because we have not been obedient to our God, we have won our victories at a fearful price, and by allowing those who hate Jesus Christ to live among us and to become wealthy and powerful, we have allowed them to set the nations of Christian Israel fighting among themselves. Nevertheless, God's prophecies that we are His battle axe and weapons of war, and that He will use us to destroy the kingdom.
Today we shall have the pleasure of hearing that lovely lady, Mrs. Bertrand L. Comparé. Her subject is The Comfort of the Scriptures. In view of the turmoil in the world and the seeming inability of men to resolve their problems, it is well to remember that there is an answer, and the answer is Jesus Christ. In the book of John we read, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." As Paul said in his first epistle to Timothy, "God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the Spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the nations," erroneously translated Gentiles, "believed on in the world, received up into glory." In the 7th chapter of Isaiah we read, "And He said, Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will ye weary my God also? Therefore the Lord Himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call His name Emmanuel, which is to say, God with us." And in the 9th chapter, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon His shoulder, And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. It is comforting to know that our God is able and faithful to his promises. Now let us join Mrs. Comparé. Inez, the...
Every time we pick up our newspapers today or listen to radio or television, we hear of wars and rumors of wars. There's rioting in Africa and Asia, Cuba and South America. Murder, rape, and violence of all kinds is rampant everywhere, even in our own country. After hearing the conditions in the world today, I think it would be comforting to hear what the scriptures have to say about all these things. In Romans 15:4, we find this: For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through patience and the comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. As one writer expressed it, for most of us, most of the time, comfort is a soft, sleek, stroking word, but not always for the Scriptures. Comfort is no softling. The word itself is like a strong man arm, comfort, fort, fortitude, fortify. In other words, strength, nothing soft about that. Fortitude to see unflinchingly, strength to stand unwaveringly. Not a lullaby, but a trumpet call. The Moffat translation of Isaiah 44 adds this: Fear nothing, dread not in the days to come. Have not I foretold it and announced it long ago? Most of us have a deep sense of needing this prophetic comfort or fortitude today. We need to know what has been written about the days in which we live so that we might have that patience and comfort. Metals are purified by melting them at great heat. The impurities rise to the top and can be skimmed off, leaving the pure metals below. We find the same idea in Psalm 92:7. When the wicked spring as the grass, and when all the workers of iniquity do flourish, it is that they shall be destroyed forever. The apparent triumph of wickedness is just the scum coming to the top to be skimmed off. Nearly all of our major troubles today were caused by the mistakes of our national leaders, who have helped our enemies into position of power instead of restraining them while they were still weak. The Bible has a great deal to say about this. For example, Isaiah 9:16 says, For the leaders of this people cause them to err, and they that are led of them are destroyed. And in Isaiah 3:12, Your leaders are misleading you, my people. They are effacing the true path for you. And again in Micah 3:1, Listen now, leaders of Jacob, judges over the house of Israel, you haters of right and lovers of wrong, is not a sense of justice due from you? I'm quoting mostly today from the Moffat translation. Hosea 4:6 said, My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. The word destroyed used here is dama, meaning to be brought to silence or be undone. In other words, ineffective. There's no strong word to say. In the midst of confusion around them, they cannot dispel it, they can only share it. And some of the ways in which we have been led astray are these. Often in the Bible, Ephraim is mentioned when it means ten-tribed Israel. And as those of you who listen to our program know, Israel today is the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Germanic, and kindred peoples. In Hosea 7:8-9, we find this very interesting comment. Ephraim allows himself to be mixed up with foreigners. Foreigners eat away his strength, unknown to him. We've been given plenty of warning not to help our enemies. For example, Give not thine honor to another, nor the things that are profitable unto thee to a strange nation. Strange meaning foreign. Baruch 4:3 and Ecclesiasticus 12:5 say, "Do well unto him that is lowly, but give not to the ungodly. Hold back thy bread, and give it not unto him, lest he overmaster thee thereby, else thou shalt receive twice as much evil for all the good thou shalt have done unto him." And in Deuteronomy 23:6, "Thou shalt not seek their peace nor their prosperity all thy days forever." Because we are giving to all our enemies all over the world, the prophet Haggai describes our condition perfectly. "He that earneth wages for a bag with holes." That's Haggai 1:6. "You pay income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, and all the hidden taxes." I believe someone figured out 26 different taxes on a loaf of bread. "After all those taxes, you probably feel as though you had put your wages in a bag with holes." Instead of fearing the division of our nation into opposing groups, divided on points of moral principle, recognize it as the hand of God separating his own from his enemies. Jesus Christ himself said, "Suppose ye that I am come to give peace on earth? I tell ye nay, but rather division." This is in Luke 12:51. Matthew 13:41-43 says, "The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who hath ear to hear, let him hear." And again, "Wait on the Lord, and keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it." This is in Psalm 37:34. And in Isaiah 26:10, "But evil men, who even in a good land will not learn to be good, they cease to be. The wicked shall be swept away, and the Eternal's majesty they shall not see." Without fear, be ready to stand firmly for the right as God shows it to you. Your prayers for his instructions will be answered. For example, Psalm 25:12 says, "Whosoever reverences the Eternal learns what is the right course to take." And in 2 Esdras 16:75, "Be ye not afraid, neither doubt, for God is your guide." In Psalm 32:6-8, "So let each loyal heart in trouble pray to thee. The floods may roar, but they will never reach him, for thou wilt be his shelter, safeguarding him in peril, surrounding him with aid. I will instruct you and teach you what is the road to take. I will give you counsel, O humble soul." And again in Psalm 94:12-13, "Happy is he who has thy discipline and thine instruction, training him calmly to wait on in adversity till a pit is dug for the ungodly." Danger? Of course there is, but when were we ever free from it? God promises that his help will bring us safely through all these dangers. Isaiah 43:1-2 says, "But now the Eternal promises, he who created you, O Jacob, he who made you, O Israel, fear not, for I will redeem you. I claim you, you are mine. I will be with you when you pass through waters. No rivers shall overflow you. When you pass through fire, you shall not be scorched. No flame shall burn you." And in Psalm 111:6-7, "The Eternal is upon my side. I have no fear. What can man do to me? I have the Eternal as my helper, so I shall feast mine eyes on my defeated foes." And in Psalm 37:10-13 and 18-19, we read, a little longer and the godless will be gone. Look in his haunts and he is there no more. The land will be left to the humble to enjoy plenteous prosperity. The godless man makes plots against the good, gnashing his teeth at them, but the Eternal laughs at him, knowing his doom is near. The fortunes of the upright are the Eternal's care, and their possessions last forever. In a calamity, they keep their share. In famine, they have plenty. When we look over the conditions in the world today, we see that the wicked do spring as the grass. Foreigners steal our strength, and our wages go into a bag with holes. Our leaders are largely to blame for these conditions. But we must be fearless, for we know that evil men will be separated from the just, and we will be given instruction and kept safely through the trouble ahead. There are many, many more scriptures along this line to give us prophetic comfort or fortitude today. Fortitude to see unflinchingly, strength to stand unwaveringly.